Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday the 28th of May, these are our main stories. Parliament in Beijing has rubber-stamped a highly controversial national security law for Hong Kong, which, among other things, allows China's intelligence agencies to be present there. As tensions rise in Hong Kong itself, at least two pro-democracy legislators have been thrown out of the territory's assembly. As we record this podcast, workers are demonstrating outside Nissan's factory in Barcelona after the Japanese car giant said it was shutting it down. Also in this podcast, after a fresh spike in coronavirus cases in South Korea, are we about to see a lockdown there? And
we have so many patients who have shown signs of COVID-19 and we are waiting for 3, 4, 5 days before we see their results. So it means we have a lot of backlog.
Problems with testing in Nigeria mean infections could be far more widespread. Chinese politicians have approved a hugely controversial security bill, which critics say will further limit freedoms in Hong Kong and threaten the one country, two systems principle there. The vote was never in doubt. Just one out of nearly 3,000 delegates voted against it. The orderly applause inside the vast National People's Congress is a stark contrast to the months of prolonged protest we've seen on the streets of Hong Kong. The chairman of the Congress, Li Jiangshu, said the legislation would strengthen law and order while preserving Hong Kong's separate legal framework.
It will uphold and improve the one country, two systems policy. It is in line with the Constitution and Hong Kong's basic law, and is in the interests of all Chinese people, including Hong Kong people.
I asked our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow how this law will change Beijing's relationship with Hong Kong.
What has been passed in Beijing today is essentially just an outline of what the law could be. It essentially says it will ban any behavior which seriously harms China's national security, such as colluding with foreign powers. But it doesn't say exactly what kind of behavior will be banned and what kind of behavior will be allowed. What it does do is just give power to China's leaders in Beijing over the next few months to come up with the details, to write the law, and then just tell Hong Kong what it's come up with. So at the moment, we've got a broad outline of what it will be, and we think that that will severely curtail freedoms in Hong Kong, as this kind of law does in mainland China.
So are there any obstacles to this actually becoming law?
Well, interestingly, lots of legal scholars in Hong Kong have suggested that there might be Beijing simply imposing this law on Hong Kong without any consultation appears to go against, and in the way they're doing it, appears to go against the mini constitution which governs Hong Kong. I'm sure, of course, the Chinese leaders will brush that aside. But further on down the road, when this law is finally imposed in Hong Kong, there are going to be questions about, well, if, for example, China's intelligence agencies are going to work in Hong Kong, whose law are they going to be answerable to? Hong Kong's law or China's law, which is a lot more broad and allows those agencies to do a lot more? If people are arrested and charged, where will they stand trial? Will they be taken back to the mainland? Will they stand trial in Hong Kong? What will be the burden of proof? Will there be any defences? All these issues have not been hammered out yet and offer opportunities for people in Hong Kong to try and perhaps, if not counter the law, at least get some clarity about what it actually means.
So there will be judicial processes to go through. Meanwhile, we've seen over the last few days, people have already been taking to the streets. There doesn't seem to have been any weakening in the resolve of protesters in the few months that people have been off those streets.
Yes, as you mentioned there, there haven't been many protests over the last few months, mainly because of the coronavirus and social distancing restrictions which have been put in place. in Hong Kong. But certainly this new national security law has reignited anger on the streets of Hong Kong against Beijing. Already been protests, more today, anger in the local assembly in Hong Kong. We're waiting to see over the next few days whether this law will translate into real mass protests like we saw later on last year. But at the moment, it certainly looks as though people are quite angry about it in Hong Kong. And they might be even more angry still when they get the actual details of what's included.
Michael Bristow. As we record this podcast, Spanish car workers are protesting in Barcelona outside factories that the Japanese manufacturer Nissan says will close in December. 3,000 jobs are to go. Protesters burned tyres outside one plant and then marched to other buildings. They wore masks but ignored social distancing. Workers had gone on strike at the start of the month in protest at plans to cut 20% of the workforce. Laura Campos is the local mayor.
We share the anger and indignation of the Nissan workers in view of this decision to dismantle all the plants in Catalonia. It's a decision which may have epic consequences, not only in terms of the loss of more than 3,000 jobs, but also in terms of the economy of the municipality of Moncada, for the region of the Western Valleys and for the country.
This report from our correspondent in Spain, Guy Hedgecoe.
The closure of this factory in the province of Barcelona is part of a restructuring plan by Nissan. The plant is the company's biggest in mainland Europe, but it had been operating well below capacity and its future had been in question for some months. However, the Spanish government has insisted that shutting the factory down will be more costly than keeping it open. Spain is now starting to emerge from a strict lockdown, which has been in place since mid-March. But many industries have already been hard hit by the coronavirus crisis, and these lost jobs will add to an unemployment rate that is rising fast.
Guy Hedgecoe. South Korea is reintroducing tougher social distancing measures after officials there recorded a fresh spike in coronavirus infections. 79 new cases were identified on Thursday. That's the highest daily figure for nearly 2 months. And it's centred on a cluster in a logistics centre in a city just west of Seoul. Our correspondent in Seoul is Laura Becker.
Well, they're not saying that this is going to be a step backwards in social distancing. They say that they're going to maintain what they call this lowest level of social distancing measures, but they are going to close kind of public parks, museums. They're urging businesses to encourage more flexible working hours. So that means back to kind of working from home if possible. Basically, this is a warning to the people in the highest areas of population, to Seoul, to the surrounding cities, because they are fearing that these infections are beginning to crop up in worrying areas. This distribution centre is just on the outskirts of Seoul. Within the last hour, we found out that there's been another kind of cluster outbreak at yet another centre right in the heart of the city. So far, Seoul, with its greater population of 25 million people, has managed to avoid the real impact of coronavirus. And health officials want it to stay this way. So they have maintained this aggressive tracing, testing, tracking policy, which has been successful so far, but it hasn't meant that they've managed to stamp out the virus completely. And that's why they're seeing these pockets of infection crop up. To stop it spreading further, they're urging measures. But it's not just to do that. They want schools to remain open. Yesterday I was in a school and it was the first time that children have been back at school for 5 months. They want the education system to get back and stay back on track. So to do that, they're urging people to be vigilant, to stay alert. And that's the kind of measures that I think they're urging today. It's a plea that's worked in the past, and I think they're hoping it will work again.
Laura Bicker in Seoul. Meanwhile, here in England, the authorities have launched a test and trace system, with the rest of the UK implementing similar measures. Our political correspondent Rob Watson explains how it should work.
Here's the idea. You feel the symptoms of COVID-19, you get a test. If you test positive, you then tell the system, the government if you like, that you've done this. They then ask you, who have you met? Who have you been within 2 metres of for the last 15 minutes or more? The government will then call round all those people that you have met and say to them, you need to isolate for 14 days. you could see the potential problems, and that is maybe somebody would feel like they had the symptoms of COVID-19 but fear that they didn't want to stay at home, lose their job or something, so may not report themselves, might not get a test. And the other problem that might happen, of course, is that people who are contacted by the government to say, you know, you were 2 meters or less from someone with the symptoms, you need to stay at home, they might not do it. Now, the government says if people don't show what I think Prime Minister Johnson called public-spiritedness, then the government would think about compulsion.
Rob Watson. There have been more than 37,000 coronavirus deaths in the UK. In the capital, many of those who have died were treated at the Royal London Hospital, from where the BBC's Clive Myrie reports.
It's often when we feel helpless that some turn to faith. At the Royal London, one of the world's top teaching hospitals, there's always a little corner for what's important, as the Muslim chaplain here, Farouk Siddiqui, kneels and faces Mecca. He prays silently in the corner of an empty ward. Imam Siddiqui is proud of the Royal London's links to local people, including one of the biggest Muslim communities in Britain.
Lisa's in charge here.
He's a man who exudes calm, while so much around him is in turmoil. The confident air is reassuring for those he counsels as he dons a surgical mask and enters the hospital room of a woman who's dying. He sees her lying in a bed looking scared, holding the hand of her partner, standing to one side. She's from Albania and survived COVID-19, but her underlying health conditions were complicated by the disease. They all begin to pray. The woman doesn't have much time. She's refused any medical intervention at the very end to save her life. The Quranic words are a balm for the dying, words Farouk has had to recite many times in this pandemic. We catch him as he leaves the room. Farouk, just how important is it for that kind of prayer to take place?
It's really important for not just the patient, but her children and the kind of extended family. It's a kind of source of comfort for them to know that they've had a chaplain, a religious figure, come, say some prayers. And this might be the last time they're able to speak and say the most important words in our faith, which is La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah, that there is no God but God, and that the Prophet Muhammad is the final messenger.
There is perhaps some solace for believers of whatever faith contained in their holy books, some meaning, says Imam Siddiqui, that might help them get through the pandemic.
But some people have been angry. Some people are still, I'd say, still absorbing what is happening and what's happened.
The rumble of trains over arches in East London is the soundtrack to the work of a group of dedicated volunteers from the nearby East London Mosque. Underneath one of the arches is a tiny morgue. And while all communities here have been hit hard by the coronavirus, it's the local Asian population that's been pummeled the most. A man in full white protective clothing and a face mask slides a dead body onto a stainless steel rack, hidden in a bag, the latest local victim of COVID-19.
At the height, we were dealing with around 25 bodies daily coming into the morgue because the cemeteries and other funeral services weren't able to cope.
Asad Jaman is part of the leadership of the East London Mosque, and he explains why they felt compelled to intervene in the disposal of bodies as Muslim dead began to pile up.
It's beyond really comprehension. You know, people would have this guilt inside the family and the community that we couldn't do the right thing for our deceased, especially the ones that suddenly passed away.
The peak may have passed, but there is a fear, as lockdown restrictions ease, that there will be more infections. For now, earthly measures like social distancing and restrictions on movement are containing the spread of the coronavirus. But many of faith pray for a divine intervention to restore those afflicted and one day soon end this tragedy.
Clive Myrie. Still to come in this edition, the show will go on. The BBC proms remotely and recorded, but just maybe live on the last night. EasyJet has become the latest airline to announce huge job losses because of the coronavirus pandemic. It says that up to 30% of its European workforce will go, which could equate to around 4,500 people. Here's our business correspondent, Ben Thompson.
The scale of the job cuts announced this morning will worry many. We've already had reaction, as you'd expect, from the unions. BALPA, that's the pilots' union, calling it an unnecessary knee-jerk reaction. They say that demand will pick back up and EasyJet is acting too quickly. We've also heard from Unite. It says it's unnecessarily hasty. But if you look at the detail that we've had from EasyJet today, they talk about demand not getting back to the levels of before this crisis until at least 2023. And so for airlines that have a lot of costs associated with just keeping their planes on the ground, they're having to come up with ways to keep their costs down. A large proportion of that, of course, will be labour costs, their staff. And so they've said they will cut 30% of the workforce. And given that it employs about 15,000 people, we expect that to be about 4,500 roles.
Ben Thompson. 3 months since Nigeria confirmed the first case of COVID-19 in sub-Saharan Africa, there are concerns that its rate of testing remains low, with fewer than 50,000 tests in a population of more than 200 million. Nigeria's Medical Association has said it believes the real number of cases in the country could be four times higher than the 8,000 already confirmed. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization is warning Africa could face a silent epidemic if its leaders don't prioritise testing. Celestina Olulode reports.
Dancing in a Lagos isolation ward, physiotherapist and patient Oluwatunde in Thegbeson encouraged those who could to keep active and stay positive. He spoke to us the day after he was finally released.
Seeing people get discharged daily gave us hope, gave us joy. We were always happy that people were getting discharged, and it was something to look forward to.
Lagos is the epicentre of Nigeria's coronavirus pandemic. Almost half of all infections in the country are here, but there's concern that there could be many more hidden cases. Less than one in every 4,000 people has been tested. Dr. Francis Faduile is the head of the country's medical association.
We are worried because the number that we have declared is still far cry from the total number that we have or we expect. We are disputing the result because we have so many patients who have shown signs of COVID-19 and we are waiting for 3, 4, 5 days before we see their results. So it means we have a lot of backlog.
In the north of Nigeria, there have been rumours of mysterious deaths. Last month in Kano, it was grave diggers who raised the alarm of a higher than usual number of burials taking place. It's led to concerns that the virus may be moving untracked through the country.
I'm a virologist and director of laboratory research at the Institute of Human Virology in Nigeria.
Dr. Dembi says he's concerned coronavirus could spread from Kano.
We have a significant number of people infected from Kano. We are all concerned that with the density of the population, that the virus will quite spread exponentially compared to other states in Nigeria.
An investigation is still underway in Kano, but in the meantime, supplies for testing materials are stretched thin. Africa is competing against a long line of countries flexing their economic, political and strategic power to secure stock for their populations. Now a pan-African initiative has been set up to help countries on the continent push through the bottleneck and procure much needed supplies. It's been called a kind of Amazon one-stop shop for coronavirus diagnostics.
The continent of Africa, a continent of 1.2 to 1.3 billion people, is lagging behind seriously in testing for COVID.
The director of the Africa Centres for Disease Control, Dr. John Nkenyasong, says the issue of testing is a challenge for the entire continent.
this is not supposed to be any subject of debate, that if you do not test many people, you will not find, and then your numbers will not reflect the actual burden. And the fear that we should have collectively as a continent, and Nigeria as the most populous country in Africa, is that is what we are missing going to hurt us.
Nigeria's Centre for Disease Control says it has moved fast to open additional laboratories, but more needs to be done and quickly to keep track of the virus and provide answers to those worried about unexplained deaths.
Celestina Olulode. To India now, where the combined forces of the lockdown and social media have somehow managed to unite a family with their lost father 2,000 kilometres away. Our South Asia editor, Jill McGivering, explains.
This was an elderly man who had speech and hearing difficulties. He was a labourer in a small village in southern India, in the state of Telangana. And just over 2 years ago, he heard there was work in a local area. He got in the back of a truck to go and try and find it, and he fell asleep in the back of the truck. The driver apparently didn't realise he was there, and when he did find him, woke him up, he left him on the side of the road. This left this rather elderly man disorientated. He tried to hitch a ride with another driver to get back home again. And by mistake, more confusion, he ended up going in quite the wrong direction for hours until he ended up in Punjab in the north of India in a big city, Ludhiana, and he didn't know how to get home again. So for fast forward 2 years, and there he is living homeless, separated from his family, living under a flyover.
Wow. So how did his family finally find him?
Well, it was all because of India's coronavirus lockdown. There was a police constable in the city who was started filming and sharing little videos online on social media that were trying to inspire acts of kindness, things that people were doing to support each other through the lockdown, particularly people who had very little and, of course, had no work. And when in one of those videos, he shows people giving food handouts to people, including this elderly man. A friend of the family happened to see it, recognised him, got in touch with the family, and basically they were then able to figure out where he was, get in touch with the police, and they have now brought him safely home back to his village.
Really interesting. It brings to mind a film of a young kid. The film was called Lion, and he went missing for years and years. But I wouldn't have thought it's that common, is it, for adults to go missing, or am I wrong?
That is a fantastic film, isn't it? And yes, as you say, based on a true story. And actually not that unusual a story. In fact, I'd met a boy that something very similar had happened to. And it does happen. About, you know, tens of thousands of children every year in India go missing, and only about half of them are ever reunited with their families. People are always concerned that one of the reasons for that could be trafficking, but a lot of them also just get lost. It's a big, busy, heavily populated country. And when people get separated, the mechanisms for putting people back in touch, especially if they've set their away from their home village or town or state, don't work very well. So very often people just get lost and they can't find their way home again.
Jill McGivering. As the weather in Europe heats up and the COVID-19 infection rates continue to fall, minds have turned to the possibility of summer holidays once more. Nowhere more so than in France, the world's number one tourist destination. It had expected to welcome 100 million visitors this year, but the pandemic means that now it's struggling to keep the tourism industry alive at all. Despite the French Prime Minister's announcement last week of a bailout of $18 billion, many people are wondering, what will the summer be like? Emma Jane Kirby among them.
Deauville Beach in Normandy. At least that's what it should sound like in the summer season. But today there are zero tourists at this upmarket seaside resort, and unless you fancy a dip between 6 and 9 a.m, the beach is also out of bounds for local swimmers and sunbathers too. Philippe Augier, who's been mayor of Deauville for nearly 20 years, says the resort has never faced a crisis on such a scale. And then there's the finances of the town to think about, he reminds me. Remember, we count on the revenues raised by the casino, by taxes on hotel stays, visitor car parking, levies on the café terraces. And that's all dried up. In mid-May, the French Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe, announced an €18 billion support package for France's tourism and hospitality sector, which generates nearly 7.5% of GDP and accounts for 2 million jobs in the country.
Donc, un cheeseburger, un California chicken wrap, des œufs comment?
The problem is the whole of France isn't on the same page. The country's now divided into COVID-specific zones. In the Latin Quarter of Paris, the hugely popular American diner, Breakfast in America, finds itself in a red zone, meaning it's a region where the virus is still prevalent, unlike Deauville, which is in a green zone. Cafes and restaurants in green zones should be able to open from June the 2nd, but there's no green light as yet for those in the red. Craig Carlson, who owns both branches of Breakfast in America, fears the very strict social distancing rules he must apply when he's allowed to reopen won't help business or client confidence.
So suddenly your 60-seat restaurant only sits 20, you know? And so I started doing the math because I'm pretty good at math. And that's when the panic started to hit. It's just like, boy, even if we do get to open, how are we going to make it?
At Guédelon in Burgundy, where a medieval castle is being built using only period techniques and tools, International Press Officer Sarah Preston is anxious for the Living History Project to be given new life, despite being in a red zone.
We are completely self-financed, so we are financed by our visitors. So once the visitors stop coming, we have no income.
For now, the French can only travel 100 kilometres from home. And with the borders closed, Guédelon is unlikely to be welcoming any overseas visitors.
Clearly, this is going to have a huge impact on overseas visitors. There's no doubt about that.
Back in Deauville, Mayor Philippe Rougier outlines his plan to reopen the town by early June. Even the beaches will have a lane system for socially distanced swimming. EU discussions continue about the possibility of opening European borders, but it's unlikely the huge numbers of British and Belgian tourists who normally visit the town will come this summer.
Emma Jane Kirby. Now, it's a global brand. For 125 years, the classical concerts with audience participation, now known as the BBC Proms, have been performed live for 8 weeks in London's Royal Albert Hall. This year, they'll be very different because of all these restrictions. They will start with a virtual event in July, but it's hoped the last night will be live from the Royal Albert Hall 8 weeks later. Our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd, told us more.
It's their 125th anniversary. Obviously, the BBC was not around at that time. They took them over decades ago. Their home now normally is the 5,000-seat Royal Albert Hall in London. It's been clear, obviously, that the 2020 proms couldn't happen in a normal way. But the BBC has now announced there will be a prom season. It will start on Friday the 17th of July. The first 6 weeks mainly repeats, a lot better than nothing, though there will, in fact, be a new commission for the first night played by the 350-member BBC Grand Virtual Orchestra, a digital mashup of 9 Beethoven symphonies. But the big news is that from Friday the 28th of August and through to the last night of the proms on the 12th of September, that's the last 2 weeks, there will be live concerts, not confirmed yet which of these may be heard on World Service Radio, as they normally are. The BBC won't give details of who's going to play, but if we assume these are all at the Albert Hall, you could spread, say, the string section of one of the BBC orchestras around the stage to play. The BBC is keeping its options open. There will be the world-famous last night of the proms, a huge bombastic event which David Pickard, who now runs the proms for the BBC, says he knew just had to go ahead.
It will still be, I hope, what the last night always is. I mean, it is an incredible national coming together, that moment, and boy, do we need that now. You know, by the time we get to the date of the last night, it will be 6 months, I think, since lockdown started. And I think, you know, the range of emotions that we've all been through during that time can be so sort of beautifully reflected in the classical music repertoire.
And Vincent, a big part of that last night is the live audience. Any idea whether or not there are going to be people in the Royal Albert Hall?
Yeah, at least 51%, I would say. Well, the BBC is being ambitious, but will there be 5,000 people in the Albert Hall? Of course not. Could there be 500 or just 200? We'll have to wait and see. I know the organisers are keen there should be. It depends how social distancing regulations go. But music lovers, not just in the UK, will be delighted. There will be some kind of proms this summer, if a rather different one.
Vincent Dowd. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.